Hello again and welcome to Voices from SA, the first episode for 2020. My name is Nicholas Claude and I hope you're well rested and I wish you a good year ahead wherever you are. Before I introduce my guests, a short announcement. For the last 2 years, Voices from SA has been made possible with the support of my wife, Kaisa. I've now decided to set up a Patreon site that will allow you, all of you, wherever you are, hopefully, to support the production and publication of Voices from SA and to enable me to spread my reach and bring you more voices of incredible people in all parts of this beautiful, crazy country. I'm thinking the price of a coffee or two. I'll let you know more information and details once the site is up and running. My guest this week is the journalist and filmmaker Richard Poplack. Richard is better known to South African readers as Journalist at Large, a title I've just assigned to him, for the Daily Maverick, where he writes under the nom de plume Trainspotter. He's recognized for his acerbic wit, biting satire, and razor-sharp observations that have infuriated and amazed in equal measure over the last 10 years or so. I pitched the discussion as a look at the year ahead and what 2020 might hold for South Africa and its people. Turns out quite a lot, and according to Richard, there's not a lot to look forward to. We chatted about a number of things, including the civil war currently racking the ANC, the parlous state of the main opposition parties, and touched on the collapse of Eskom, the state-owned power utility, as a metaphor for the impact of corruption in South Africa. Richard also gives some background to the documentary film he has directed together with Diane Neal. It's called Influence, and it takes an in-depth look at the rise and fall of the PR firm Bell Pottinger. The film will premiere at the Sundance Film Festival on January the 23rd. There is some swearing in this episode. Please now enjoy my chat with Richard. I was reading in the... Richard, thanks for your time, by the way.
Hey, it's really good to be back, Nick. Thank you.
I know you've been incredibly busy, and I kind of feel bad because you were one of the first people I actually interviewed for this podcast series about 3 years ago, and I don't know, it just kind of got away from me as the thing took off. And I did it maybe too early in the process, and it just kind of felt not right at the time. So I appreciate you now taking
the
time to talk to me.
No, anytime, absolutely.
I thought I'd cheer you up with this. In a world gone mad, I was reading The Guardian this morning, and the Hadley Freeman headline is, "Why is Gwyneth Paltrow selling a candle that smells like her vagina?"
Well, why wouldn't she? You know, I mean, I feel like we've sort of arrived at this point in late capitalism where...
I mean, what does that say?
You know, if the wick doesn't smell like a vagina, it's not going to sweat. So, look, I mean, capitalism's in a great spot. I mean, my favorite hint at where late capitalism is going is the $80 million payout that the outgoing CEO of Boeing is receiving. So, in other words,
I thought you were going to talk about that WeWork guy as well.
Oh, that lunatic, and I mean, I'd recommend to anybody.
I think he was a bill.
Yeah, it was outrageous. But I think that for a CEO who presided over the deaths of, I think it was 400 people,
yeah.
To walk away from not successfully being able to build an aircraft that flies, you get an $80 million pay. I mean, if that doesn't suggest to you that the system is rigged, I'm not entirely sure what evidence you're waiting for.
Yeah. So I had not heard that, but, and I suppose, as you say, one shouldn't be shocked. Who was that... the Goshen Nissan guy escaping from Japan.
Unbelievable story.
I mean...
Unbelievable story.
I was kind of out of the news cycle over Christmas, and I came back to that, and I was... I mean, where can it go from here?
It's an unbelievable story. Carlos Josen, I guess Goshen, is how you pronounce Josen, it. Goshen. Flees Japan in a private jet. He was placed in a box.
There's a movie there for sure.
No, there's several. It's extraordinary. So yeah.
Look,
maybe it always feels like the end of days, but wow, if 2020 doesn't feel like another hinge year, I'm not entirely sure what would.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was in that sort of post 9/11, the war in Iraq kind of days, George Bush presidency, when you thought geez, you know, this thing's really gone a bit tilt now. Cheney and those guys, Rumsfeld, sort of pontificating in a very pious manner on as they slaughtered thousands. Now it's kind of, okay, you can drone strike the head of the military of a country you're not at war with in a third country, and it's like there's another day of work,
an
ever-changing
right?
sort of narrative to justify it. And so, you know, where does that leave a country like South Africa that's really struggling now to kind of find its way in the world, let alone find its way on the continent or as a democracy? Mm. And you see this kind of crazy behavior and you think, well, are those the examples now that are set out for governance and for political behavior in the world today?
And I think the answer to that question is yes. Let me share with you the fact that I was thinking about this exact thing this morning, actually. I was thinking about, to what extent are South Africa's political problems, which are, and let me emphasize, they're existential. This country is in as deep a mess as you can find yourself, and it's not about to get better. It's about to get worse. Mm. So the question I have to myself is, to what extent are these problems a symptom of a global malaise, and to what extent are these problems specifically local?
And
I think once we start to do the work to untangle those questions, we tend to be very parochial here. We tend to think of South Africa as an exceptional case.
Yeah, exactly. We're the only ones that have these kinds of problems.
You know, this is a Zuma thing or this thing or this thing. You know, our political malaise is a symptom of something larger, and I think these are global trends. You know, as you know, I've been working for the last 2 years on a feature-length documentary about Bell Pottinger, the famous PR company that ended its lifespan here in South Africa, working for Oak Bay, the Gupta company, and doing some really, really awful work. And what Bell Pottinger were very good at was working on the dividing lines that exist within all societies, within all democratic societies. And I think where we find ourselves right now is at the end of a cycle when it comes to how democracies can healthily function. In other words, what makes us strong can be weaponized and used against us. The very fact that we can sit down and have open discourse is weaponized by those who understand that there's profit to be made on creating division and chaos. So that's a really, really interesting, there's a really, really interesting debate to be had about the collision between democracy and extreme capitalism. And I think that's where South Africa finds itself. It finds itself very much in this global phenomenon that pits the best of us, the fact that we can have open debate in open forums, against the fact that that can be monetized, weaponized, and purchased by the highest bidder.
Because I think today you see more and more that democracy is just an illusion, and that it is capital that is the dominant force in the world. The rapacious requirement for profit at all costs.
Correct.
And any means justify the ends, it seems. There's no forest that will remain untouched.
No, nothing.
There will be no community that will remain untouched as long as there's some money to be made. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that kind of where you think we are now?
I think.
Or have we always been there?
Yeah, every last sacred cow has been turned into a McDonald's hamburger. You know, it's one of these things where... again, I want to sort of try to demonstrate how this unfolds in a South African context. We tend to get very lofty about the origins of our democracy and how our democracy functions. The fact that there does exist in this country one person, one vote, and a parliamentary system that, you know, to a degree does function. I mean, there are committees,
an independent judiciary, freedom of the
press, but the core of the democratic process in this country comes down to a very, very flawed electoral system, which is effectively rule by majority, a majoritarian rule, one party rule, right?
And also combined with a list system that is kind of unaccountable, really.
Well, it is accountable. It's accountable to capital. So the person with the biggest checkbook manages to buy the most ANC delegates. Those delegates determine who becomes the president of the ANC, and that choice determines who becomes president of the country. So in other words, we have a system where 5, 6, 10, 12 oligarchs get to choose who runs the country. And that is fundamentally unsustainable. So without a representative system in this country, without a system that allows for smaller parties to flourish, we end up in the situation that we're in right now, where the ANC basically gets to have the say. And it's unsustainable, and it's just not going to work.
Well, I mean, we say unsustainable, and everyone's saying, like, the next election is going to be the last election that the ANC are going to win. And that was, like, maybe even... I suppose they did lose some cities in the municipal elections, but they still do seem to be quite an impregnable sort of political force in the country. Absolutely.
But that's the point. The point is that the majoritarian rule is the grip is ironclad. And what's more, as I think we've seen over the course of the past 6-7 months, is the complete implosion of a viable opposition. The first thing, how is that demonstrated? I mean, the DA is just gone Looney Tunes. I mean, Helen Ziller effectively, the former leader, but she is the leader of the DA, and she has transformed that that organization into what is effectively a... I hesitate to use the term white supremacist to define the DA. I would certainly call Helen Ziller a white supremacist without any compunction. The DA is Western supremacist. And they view their own sort of self-view is that they're a clean version of the kind of social democratic government that the ANC professes to want to implement. So, but they can't do that. And they can't do that because they're incoherent. They can't do that because the party has sort of flown to pieces, largely because the woman who holds the purse strings is a right-wing nut job. On the other end, on the so-called left, you have the EFF. And really, at this stage in 2020, all that really needs to be said about them is that they're a highly functional syndicate. They're a mafia. They're kind of like the ANC, except sleeker, better, meaner, and faster. And that's where we are.
Because I wanted to... I mean, the question here I had was... who or what is the EFF? And my other question was, how does the DA become relevant again, if it ever was relevant? I suppose there was a moment for both of those parties,
absolutely,
particularly during the Zuma era.
Look, first,
the late Zuma years,
yeah,
where they had an opportunity to bring something different to the table, and
Instead
they were just focused, I think, on Jacob Zuma, the president, and thought that that was going to be the ticket to the big time. Or
I think that's largely true. I mean, so much of the focus in those years was on Zuma, and he was the political gift, at least for the opposition, that kept on giving.
And yet they still could not.
Well, in the DA's case, I think the natural ceiling was about 28-29%. One of their big mistakes was believing they could be the majority in parliament. It was never going to happen. But I think, having a third of the seats in parliament in the most powerful country in Africa is a great thing.
Yeah.
And I think what they once could have expected to have done was to have the Western Cape, have Gauteng, and have the four big metros. And I think that would have been a wonderful rebuke
platform
to the African National Congress and a wonderful platform to implement their policies. The problem is they really didn't have any policies, which is to say their policies were minor deviations on what the ANC was offering, with the proviso that they would do it cleanly and less corruptly. The dog whistle promise was that they were the white ANC.
And also there was the confusion on race in a way, their whole affirmative action thing. And
yes,
like, if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, everyone must work hard. We're kind of all born equal in this country kind of thing, which seems completely kind of absurd,
Well, it does, but that's not, I'm not going to speak for anyone, but I don't think, from the work that I've done, I don't think that's unappealing to a certain segment of the voting population in this country. In other words, there is home for a socially conservative, fiscally conservative right-wing party in this country. You know, I mean, what makes a democracy healthy is not that you like all the parties that exist, but that the marketplace is healthy, that there's choice for voters who can go here, and shop around at the very least. So, you know, I always... My hope for the DA is that it would become the best version of itself, which was to throw off the shackles of kumbaya nonsense, get down to the brass tacks of being a right-wing alternative to the ANC. And I think if they'd gone down that path, firming up some of their policies, becoming a bit less afraid of what promise is held in truly owning up to being right of center.
Yeah.
I think they could have become a very, very viable alternative for a lot of voters, black, white, and in between.
Honest sort of conservatives.
Honest conservatives, you know. Again, you don't have to like that, but that's not the point of a democracy. The point of a democracy is that there's some kind of choice, some kind of marketplace in the political sphere.
Do you think we sort of as members of the white bourgeois elite do still misunderstand the legacy and the, I suppose, the hold, the awe in which the ANC is viewed by the vast majority of this country, that they really don't seem to be judged in the way a normal political party should be judged?
Well, hang on.
In terms of...
Look, I mean, again, I'm not going to speak for every member of the white elite bourgeoisie, although perhaps I should.
Give it a go.
As an emblematic member of the white bourgeoisie, my job is not to see this country through the eyes of the white elite, but rather to go out on the ground and report. The ANC means different things to different voters. Lest we forget the fact that the ANC set up a grant program in this country, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest in the world. There's 17 million grant recipients in this country. They rely on the ANC for their subsistence level survival. So in other words, when we say that voters vote in their best interests, it's not the fact that anyone can really afford to look 10, 20, 50 years into the future and say, clearly we're on the wrong path, but that I need to eat tomorrow. And if we start to look at the ANC in that regard, never mind the brand, which is significant, and we understand that most of the voting population in this country is 30, 40, 50 and above, right? The people are voting for the ANC in their own self-interest. When you are on the periphery, when you're on the fringe, any change is a bad thing. The devil you know really is not much of a devil at all. And I think that is that's something we fail to understand. Once you enter the rural areas of this country, it's a different place. And flyover country in South Africa, the places that are properly underreported on, they survive in this ecosystem that the ANC has set up. Ward councillor, branch, municipal, provincial, national. Those lines of patronage are immensely entrenched. And so, you know, it's not that there's this blanket, blind, brand-based attachment to the African National Congress. That's not really it. So much as there are these webs of affiliation, these webs of need, and these webs of attachment that are, first of all, difficult to unpick, and second of all, pretty freaking inviolable. And I think that's something that needs to be taken into consideration when you think about a party as large, as sophisticated, and at times as moneyed as the ANC.
I want to come back to a couple of these things. I suppose what strikes me there about, particularly about the grant system, which is, obviously a massive social program, a very impressive social program, but supported by a tax base that I would think is probably, to a large degree, anti-ANC in the first place, and that actually lives completely outside of the kind of state. If yes. I can talk about private security, private healthcare, private schooling. So there's that's a crazy kind of relationship in a way.
It is, and I think that's one of the phenomenons of the developing world that I think will slowly start to translate itself into the developed world. And that is the phenomenon of a very small income tax paying base. Keep in mind that every South African pays VAT on purchases, etc. Even those who receive social grants, they also are taxpayers effectively. The income tax paying base in this country is very, very small. And you're right, they exist outside of the state, which sets up this interesting relationship between the state and it's effectively the people who pay for it, and makes it enormously susceptible to money flowing offshore and make it enormously susceptible to a tax revolt, which to an extent I think is happening in this country. You look at Eskom, at SARS's shortfalls every year, they're pretty large. And I think
that's not only due to a breakdown in the SARS infrastructure.
Well, that, of course it is. That's a large part of it as well. But it's also, it's also a flat, plain revenue shortfall. If and when that taxpayer base shrinks, this country enters complete meltdown, and it will.
Richard, I just want to talk a little bit about you and your work. You're a journalist. Mm-hmm. Is that how you would define yourself?
Sure.
If you want to, you've written for a lot in South Africa. I think South Africans mainly would know you. You do a lot of freelance writing around the world, but know you through the writing you've done at the Daily Maverick. Under nom de plumes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hannibal Elector initially, and now Trainspotter. Mm-hmm. Can you just explain to me how you chose those two nom de plumes and what they sort of allow you to do?
Well, they were both names actually were pitched by my editor at Daily Maverick, Branko Berkic. And the rationale behind them is that we wanted to not create a persona so much as an attitude that would be emblematic for the publication, but also sort of set a tone of a satirical irreverence, but also deep seriousness and deep reporting. So in other words, kind of create a space for ourselves that did not exist in South Africa at the time. I guess those sort of nom de plumes freed up a whole bunch of psychic space for me to go kind of totally fucking wild.
I'm just
and to go pretty gonzo and create a body of work that I'm quite proud of. I think it's been a wacky ride.
I must apologize for not having anything in front of me to read back to the listener. I would ask any of you listening to go and look up any of Richard's stuff, because it's when you write some of those lines, do you giggle to yourself a little bit and think, oh, that's gonna piss him off for sure, or is it a kind of stream of consciousness?
Yeah, it's more
thing,
that.
Or
yeah, I mean, it is much more stream of consciousness. I mean, I shouldn't say it isn't crafted. It is, but it really is kind of.
You're pushing yourself all the time to be a bit more out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just kind of opening the internal floodgates a little bit and letting the shit pour out. But
the same time, I mean, there's a lot of research as well, right? There's a lot of facts. So that's what always strikes me is that you can't dismiss your writing, because there's obviously a lot of work. It's not like you just roll up in front of the computer, right? I mean,
no. The writing has changed because, when you're on the beat for over, I don't know how long I've been on it for. I don't even want to guess. It must be
coming for 10 years.
Yeah, it sort of becomes internalized. And what you start to be able to rely on, not only from yourself, though, but, from others around you, and the Daily Maverick ecosystem is pretty rich, is sort of an institutional memory that is born of experience and is born of being on the road. Some people refer to me as an analyst. I'm not. I've spent most of my life on the road with a notebook. A lot later than my contemporaries of the same age. I consider myself first and foremost a reporter. Even on this movie that we've just done, a lot of it is reporting based. It's not sitting down in a room speaking to a talking heads, which is not, and there's nothing wrong with that. What I'm saying is that that's not what I do. So it's it's kind of this merging of a kind of wild voice with what I hope could be considered decent reportage, which Branko felt was missing from the space here in South Africa at the time.
Yeah, no, it's definitely unique. I mean, I love that. I just want to go back a little bit. You were born in South Africa.
Yes,
in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
And then your family moved to Canada, is that right? Mm-hmm. How old were you when you moved to Canada?
17.
So what year was that then?
That would have been 1990.
Okay. And what was the thinking behind that move?
No, my folks wanted out of here. I mean, this was you know, I'm not going to pretend I came from some, you know, intensely liberal family. I didn't. And the thinking at the time was that they didn't want me to do my service in the army.
Right.
Were pretty hairy here, and they didn't want anything to do with this place anymore. Yeah. That was their rationale.
And then you moved back here?
I moved back here. Yeah. I mean, I traveled quite widely, worked in a bunch of different places, lived in a bunch of different places, but I, you know, it became very clear to me, as the 2000s wore on, that where I wanted to be was here. And I wanted to come back home, and I wanted to work here.
Yeah.
I wanted to work in Africa. I also worked in the Middle East. I think I filed from 30 developing world countries. You know, it was important for me to come back to what I felt I knew from my childhood and try to make some sense of how things had changed. And in doing that, to make sense of change, you know, to make sense of what had happened to the world after the fall of the Berlin Wall, of which South Africa was, you know, I truly believe we're part of that phenomenon.
Sure,
you can't understand the end of apartheid if you don't understand that. And just to try to understand what was happening around us. Now, that was back in 2005. Here we are, 2006. Here we are 15 years later. And the vapors that I saw kind of swirling around me, I'm not going to sit here and pretend to you that I understood how it would all unfold, but those vapors have solidified and become manifest in extraordinary ways. And the breakdown of the systems that we believed were uncrackable has happened with astonishing rapidity. And the Jacob Zuma era was a canary down the coal mine. When it came to that, so much of what other countries are experiencing right now, we experienced first, you know, due to a fake populist kleptocrat whose intention was to govern by breaking down the state, to rob by breaking down the state. He understood that the state was a was an inhibiting factor to the kind of chaos you need to do the work that he wanted to do.
Yeah, there's never, I suppose, been a person on the planet who's done so much to avoid the day in court that he's desperately after, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, wow, if you want to talk about a court dodge, that man is a grand master. He's like a freaking ninja.
What's even the Zondo Commission now today?
Now he's sick, and the insinuation, I guess, is that he's been poisoned by bad comrade. You know, it's all the usual bullshit. I mean, you know, it gets so fucking exhausting at a point that it's just, you know, you just got to roll your eyes. But he is the kind of disgusting, emblematic figure that should have but didn't shine a light on where we were going. There's a guy in Washington, D.C. who is his direct corollary. Ditto the UK, all over the world. You know, I'm not saying he was an inspirational figure, but there's so much we can learn about South Africa starting in 2009 that can teach the world about, first of all, how much damage you can do to a country so quickly, and second of all, the virtual impossibility of building up a estate after it's been wrecked to the extent that ours was during the Zuma era.
Well, I suppose we still do have a functioning judiciary.
No, there's elements of the state that function, of course, but in the middle of it, and Jacob Zuma to a degree knew that the judiciary is a salve only to a certain extent, right? Because
so he wasn't really too focused.
Well, I mean, he wasn't that focused on it, and he also understood that it's the same thing that Americans, Canadians, the British will say about judgments that don't go their way. It's an activist judiciary. In other words, you politicize every single judicial decision, and that starts to wear down the institution in the minds of the people in the country. And I think that's been done to a middling degree in this country. But it turned out that it wasn't necessary to destroy the judiciary when you're so effectively robbing. State-owned enterprises to the extent that we have. The existential crisis doesn't come from the fact that you can't get a judgment on someone smashing into your car. I mean, who fucking cares? I mean, it does exist in South Africa, a baseline rule of law. But that doesn't matter when there's $40 billion missing from Eskom. You know?
And the lights keep going out.
You know, and every other state-owned enterprise is in the same situation.
Yeah.
And we can't, you know, as you say, we can't keep the lights on. Who cares if there's rule of law? What difference does it make?
I sort of, when we were chatting about this this particular discussion, I did want to sort of look a little bit ahead to what the year might hold, and I did write ESCOM and SOEs. Mm. It seems that the ANC has a deep inability to sort of confront reality.
Mm.
Is that just because the ANC is completely and totally corrupted and has to keep these taps open? Or is it, I'm just trying to sort of, I don't even really understand myself where the ANC is right now in terms of, you know, the Cyril Ramaphosa hallelujah moment. Praveen Gordon now seems to be completely sort of been thrown under the bus by everyone, it seems. What the hell?
Well, there's two things. First of all, you're right. The ANC is a sclerotic organization that can't see further than its nose. The second thing is that the reality that they're confronting is unconfrontable. I mean, how do you fix Eskom? Well, here's how you fix Eskom. You break it up and you privatize it. Now, that's untenable in this current political environment because it means tens of thousands of people losing their jobs, and likely the independent IPPs, as we call them here, likely going to private institutions that are not politically acceptable in this country, by which I mean white private enterprises. So the only way to save Eskom, and don't for a second think that I'm, I would always advocate the denationalization of a power utility. I think there's trillions of ways in which a nationalized power utility can work if the state is a honest actor.
Hmm.
But in South Africa, it isn't. So there's only one answer to Eskom. And even there, we're on tenuous ground. You have to find power producers who have the equity partners willing to tolerate the risk of taking on all of the liabilities that Eskom has.
Hmm.
Right? But we're talking about firing 10,000 people. In a country with real unemployment that is probably nudging over 40%.
Yeah.
So how do you do that? That's war, right? And that is the only solution. There's no other solution. Or rather, the other solution is the nuclear option, and that is that we cede, much as SAA has done, by ceding political authority by asking for business rescue, that this country goes to the IMF, and it will.
Hmm.
Yeah. I've seen all sorts of theories and why it won't, and we're not there, and this and this and this, and you know, and the rand itself is a magical currency. Hmm. I mean, it fluctuates. I don't know to which market reasoning it sort of adheres itself, but it's an extraordinary, it's like, as I think I mentioned once, it's like the Joker. Yeah. You just don't know what this fucking thing is going to do. But that's not enough to save us.
There still is something here somehow, isn't there, from global markets? Or
and that's largely because our emerging partner competitors are so fucked as well, right? So, you know, I mean, the South African Reserve Bank remains an independent institution that's by and large very well governed. The JSE remains by and large liquid and well governed. I mean, there are pockets of functioning institutions in this country. The point is, where the state becomes the lead actor, they can't be trusted. So we have a problem.
The World Bank, was it just last week, predicted now 1% growth for the economy this year, which is pretty much like negative growth, isn't it?
Well, it's negative growth in a country where the population grows at the rate that ours does.
And, I mean, you were saying unemployment is at 40%. I was just, I sort of noticed these things, which I call sort of like overemployment almost, because, you know, you walk into restaurants, there's like three times as many waiters as are required. You go to your local mall, and every automatic ticket dispenser has somebody standing by the ticket dispenser, which seems kind of unnecessary.
Yes.
Went to the cinema the other day. It's a completely automated process, and yet there's like five people milling around as well. They got jobs. They're employed. Tito Mboweni last week was talking about, you know, restructuring, and we need, you know, to change things. And I'm just wondering what can be done. You know, in Europe now, they're talking about the fourth industrial revolution and sort of retraining of workers into new kinds of work in the changing nature of work. But to do that, you need a kind of fairly educated, literate workforce in the first place, which seems to be something we are lacking here, let alone the sort of IT infrastructure that's going to allow for any of this sort of retraining or whatever. I mean, what is now the future of the South African economy?
Well, I mean, what you're describing is the awful term labor surplus. You know, this vile conceit that when you have so many people out of work, you kind of have your choice about the bodies that you place next to machines that do that in any other place would do their work for them. There's just so many people out of work that we can afford to hire people cheaply in this country. There's nothing more gross than this notion of GDP growth, that every year we need to grow, make more stuff, burn more things, you know, raise more forests, build more shit, sell more cars.
Key reporting must be
exactly,
the analysts have said.
And it's all so filthy and disgusting. But by, you know, these are the measuring tools that we use. And by the measuring tools that are used globally, South Africa is failing by every measure. And you know, until we figure out, and I've never really seen why we couldn't be pioneers in this regard. Growth without growth, you know, change without growth, you know, advancement without growth. I've never really understood why we couldn't innovate on that point at least. I mean, we have everything going for us in that regard. We're not growing. We need to innovate. We need to change, but we refuse to. And so we remain led by people with an enormously narrow view of how the world is supposed to function. One of the most powerful people in cabinet, Gwede Mantashe, is effectively a gerontocrat and a kleptocrat who...
Gerontocrat?
Old. who rule by the old, who sees coal as in the same way that Trump does, no idea about climate change, not interested. For him, it's about take it out of the ground and burn it, and that is not the future of this country. It's just not. It's weird. It's almost like, it's not almost like, it's exactly like the ANC is totally out of step with reality. And so, yeah, we allow ourselves to rot, mostly because we refuse to innovate and refuse to see the world as it is.
I was reading an article, actually, I'll point you to that, in the New Yorker, interview with William Gibson.
When was that?
Within the last couple of weeks. I'll send you the information.
Okay.
You've read some of
his... He's brilliant. I've
read some of the early stuff, Mona Lisa, Overdrive, and Neuromancer. I haven't really touched on his more recent stuff, but I mean, he's a guy who's written always very beautifully about the near present, or even the current, or even the present now, as he's saying. I mean,
the future isn't here. The future's here. It just isn't evenly distributed. That's his great line.
And he's even talking about his latest book, where he was speculating about, well, Brexit. Well, you know, he's written something about Brexit, and then it happened. So he was like confused about what he needed to write now. Well, then he was wondering about Turkey and Syria, and then the goddamn war. And like, it's all moving too fast for him, in a way, in the way to sort of feed his genre or style of imagination. But he was saying, which I thought was quite prescient, given also Davos now, discussions about all these sort of platitudes about climate change that the multinationals and global capitalists come up with every year, it seems, over the last at least 3 or 4 years, saying, you know, Trump, okay, maybe we can survive the worst of Trump and the kind of we're okay, maybe we survive the worst of Brexit, but you know, we're still kind of there. But he says climate is going to come and get us all. Climate change.
Of course. Yeah.
Australia's burning. I mean, I can't even track how many hundreds of thousands of hectares of forests. They say a billion creatures, hundreds of species.
No, I mean, it's just.
And yet, it's kind of, I don't know, Kaiser said she watched somebody being interviewed outside their house that had just burned down, saying, yeah, I know this happens all the time, kind of this forest, you know, the climate changes and the wind and the rain.
You look at calamity coming.
To reflect on your coal.
Yeah, maybe it is too much to take in, Nick. Maybe it is too much to take in. I don't know. Maybe species do commit suicide simply because they don't have the genetic imagination to understand their own doom.
And we are that species.
And maybe we are that species, and maybe there is some kind of weird metaphysical cleansing going on. Or maybe there is just a vengeful God. I have no fucking idea. What I do think we could do is start to think wisely about how we treat our environment, especially in a country like South Africa. If we aren't growing, and we're not, then shouldn't we be thinking about new ways of treating the land? We have a population
here. Or new ways
of
producing energy.
Yeah, we have a populist movement here that is crying out for the land. And yet that movement isn't tied to any meaningful climate change discourse. It's like, wait a second. So you want these denuded patches of nothingness for what purpose exactly? To say that you have them? To redress what? I mean, we understand the political process behind land reclamation and land redress. We understand how important that is politically. We understand how important that is emotionally. But what I don't understand is why these two discourses aren't merged. Right, so effectively in this country, there is no climate change discourse.
No, it doesn't.
Certainly not at the highest level, not even at the populist level. I mean, the EFF, you know, guys in their mid-30s and younger, educated men, and I mean men, who refuse to acknowledge the fact that we need a new discourse in this country, and that refuse to merge their fake notions of the left with what should be very real concerns for climate, especially if one of your programs is land redress. It's absurd. So that for me is a huge indicator of how moribund, blind, and myopic the political thinking in this country is. We're running out of water. You know, the Cape Town water crisis was a mix between data that showed the trends of a drying Western Cape very, very clearly.
Some time back.
We're talking dating back to the 90s,
yeah.
Saying that the catchment areas in that provide for Cape Town are getting drier and drier and hotter all the time. And misgovernance. You know, the greatest governed city in South Africa was actually very, very poorly governed. And so the merging of those two things, catastrophically bad governance with a changing climate, Nick, you do the math. It's not good.
I want to speak a little bit now about the documentary you alluded to a little bit earlier, if I may, and just if you could just explain how the documentary came about. The background was very much the Bell Pottinger in South Africa, white monopoly capital narrative that started to emerge, five years ago. Just take us through a little bit how you got involved and some background. What is the topic or the subject matter of the documentary?
So I've co-directed a documentary called Influence with a woman named Diana Neal, who's a journalist and filmmaker. She came to me shortly after the Gupta leaks were broken. We were all working very hard on the Gupta leaks. She was running an outfit at Daily Maverick called Chronicle, which was, I suppose, their AV club. It was supposed to start trying out a whole bunch of multimedia solutions to the news, and they were constantly experimenting. It was actually a very exciting time. And she came to me and said, would I be interested in helping her with a documentary that delved into Bell Pottinger? Bell Pottinger, of course, was the PR agency who came to work for the Guptas and re-injected into our political discourse the terms white monopoly capital and radical economic transformation, and did a hideously shit job of trying to hide their tracks, I suppose. As everyone knows, they came a cropper here in South Africa. But what our mandate was to go deep into this company's history. And we started to uncover some really, really interesting stuff that they've been doing over the years. Chile, we went and did, we shot in Chile. We shot here in Cape Town and Johannesburg. We shot in Washington, D.C. We shot extensively in London. And we shot in Iraq as well. So it's sort of this globe-trotting thriller that takes in the sweep of this company that goes a long way, in our opinion, to explaining the post-truth era and to explaining how misinformation functions in divisive societies like our own.
And you're going to be showing or premiering at the Sundance Festival, is that?
Yeah, that's right. They're very excitingly.
Do you have a date for that?
Yeah, the premiere's on the 27th of January.
Congrats.
Thank you very much. Very excitingly, we're the first South African directors to be in competition in the documentary, in the world documentary segment. So, yeah, it's a big moment for us. It's a big moment for Daily Maverick. It's a big moment for South African cinema, I think. So it's kind of great, it's very, very exciting.
All the best with that. I said earlier, without any spoilers, is there a moment in that process where you learned something that you didn't know before? Can you give me one?
Look, we delve into detail that I think has largely remained uncovered with regard to the 94 elections in this country. And I think where South African viewers will sit up and take notice is in that section of the film. We've done some work, I think, that will surprise many people here, and it's pretty bone-chilling. So, yeah, it's a film that does come with a few surprises. It's a nasty little movie, as one would expect.
As one would hope for.
It'll give, hopefully, it'll give audiences here a snort clap, and hopefully it'll resonate with a global audience, because it really is meant to be an international film.
Well, I mean, you know, working in news, I was wondering about that. You know, you working in news in, as you say, the sort of post-truth era, how do you remain committed to your craft in this context?
I tend to take a long-term view of things. And by that, I mean that our culture, our democracies, our political systems are in the shit right now. But there remains something called verifiable fact. And those are the building blocks of my profession. I'm not saying for a second I don't get it wrong. I'm not saying for a second there aren't institutions that deliberately get it wrong. And I'm not saying for a second that news, that the news as a business is in a terrible state at the current time and needs to become more inclusive and more diverse, blah, blah, fucking blah. But irrefutable, inviolable fact remains a fact. And that's what I traffic in. So, you know, there are mechanisms by which you can test facts. There are mechanisms by which you can take me to task if I get those facts wrong. To me, that system holds pretty damn well. And it's not for me. And this is hard to explain to people who think I should be fed up and think I should want to shoot myself, which sometimes I do. It's that it's not about one story. It's about a career of stories, and you're adding to the journalist next to you career of stories, and the next to him, and next to her, and next to her, and next to him. So in other words, you're building beneath you, or contributing to the building of a civilization. And that's a long-term project, and history is not linear. You know, it goes up and down. So I tend not to panic.
I wanted to one of the things I wanted to do was, and maybe we haven't done that too well in this discussion, was look a little bit ahead to 2020. I mean, what do you think are going to be, for South Africa at least, the major events, or what do you expect? Yeah, on a sort of political, economic level, if you could look into your crystal ball.
Well, I think the war in the ANC is only going to intensify leading up to July, where the ANC has a big sit down, and Cyril Ramaphosa will be hard pressed to keep his position. I do not think Pravin Gordhan will last the year in any ministry. Frankly, I think the Fight Back faction is doing a pretty good job, especially with the backing of the EFF. Johannesburg remains effectively ungoverned. You know, our big cities are in a terrible situation. So we're in a war. We're in as dangerous and undeclared a civil war as we were in the 90s, in the early 90s. You know, the body count is different. But if you notice, the body count in the civil wars happening all around the world, America, everywhere, there is no body count. None to speak of. I mean, if you think about the Civil War in the States, the first one, we're talking hundreds of thousands of dead. Here you're talking about hundreds. That element of civil wars have changed. But what hasn't changed is the chaos that they bring in, the divisiveness that they bring in, and the destruction that they usher in. We will need to reconceive of corruption as a crime against humanity. I mean, I think that's the next evolution in how we think about crimes against humanity. We need to start generating the narrative that corruption murders the future, right? Murders future possibility for people, especially people on the margins, especially the poor. And what corruption has done in this country is murder the future of tens of millions of people. And until we are able to fully communicate that narrative, I think there's a misconception that corruption ends up basically being a victimless crime and isn't the prosecutable offense that it should be.
On that bleak note...
I only do bleak, bro. That's my brand.
That really has left me with a pit in the hollow of my tummy. Richard, thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's
I appreciate
pleasure.
That. Yeah. And all the best with the docu at Sundance and, thanks, and beyond.
And it's kind of thrilling that that your thing's been going on for 3 years. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement. Whoa.
Thanks for that. I'm normally a half glass full kind of person, trying to see the positives in anything. Well, for the most part. Richard, not so much, but a fascinating and sometimes frightening discussion for sure. I thought his idea of classing large-scale corruption as a crime against humanity compelling. It was, I think, Kevin Bloom, who's an old friend of Richard's, the environmental activist, who said climate denialists should be also or climate denial should be classed as a crime against humanity a few months ago. So, yeah, that's something to consider. Difficult to predict what might happen in South Africa over the coming year. I mean, geez, the last 10 years have just been crazy. And one thing's for sure, it's going to be action-packed. ANC factions battling it out. Eskom struggling to keep the lights on. Opposition parties jostling for influence, both in parliament and the provinces. And that's just kind of touching on issues we discussed in this episode. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.